Are you ready, kids? Get your parents' permission, check your mailbox, and grab your shopping cart. It's time for the Adventures in Collecting podcast.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Dave.
Welcome to Adventures in collecting,
where we talk toy news, culture, and hauls,
along with our journeys as collectors. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Adventures in Collecting.
Hey, everybody.
Oh, switching it up. You kept the long pause. Switched up your catchphrase a little bit this week, Dave.
I wanted to mix it up for everybody.
Well, as has been the case of the past few episodes, we are back again this week with another guest. And I don't know if Dave has a lead-bearing pun waiting for us in the wings here.
I don't. I'm going to be more surprised if we have a lead to bury at this point.
I mean, that's fair. That's fair. Because, you know, as we mentioned, and if you guys have been listening to the show, we have had quite a few guests on as of late. And this week is, this is no different. So
an array. A wide array.
Definitely. Definitely. A swath, one would say. Or one could say. So today, Dave, I think it behooves us to mention that Akira Toriyama's Dragon Ball story began as a serialized manga and has been a global phenomenon for nearly 40 years now, which is crazy to think about. It has spawned countless TV shows, films, and yes, of course, toys and collectibles. Joining us today on the show is Cisco Maldonado, Bandai America's Senior Director of Brand Strategy, to talk to us about their Dragon Stars line of products, their anime heroes, and so much more. Cisco, welcome to Adventures in Collecting.
Wow, well, thanks for having me on. You said my last name correctly, so kudos.
I like to chalk it up to the fact that, I know I'm speaking for Dave and I here, we're both really big sports fans, so you get, like, access to all of these like names from all over the world, whether it's like soccer players or baseball players or football players. So we've had some practice with the linguistics of multicultural last names.
Got it. So if I had said my last name was like X-Wing at Aliciousness or something like that, you would get it then.
Yes. And I was going to say, Dave, the other thing too is, of course, pronouncing people's Instagram handles on this show.
Oh yeah, that's. It's really just more of me trying to guess what you're trying to get across as the Instagram handle.
Like, okay. Here's a little Easter egg for you guys. My gamer tag is Fireproof Koala. If that should pique your interest.
I mean, koalas are very not fireproof. Is that the irony of your name?
The irony is, I've had several mishaps with actual koalas, and as a result, I have less than the optimal amount of affection for those animals. And over the course of my life, people have just teased me with koalas because I had a negative experience with one, and it grew into its own meme just between me and my friends and those who know me. And so a fireproof koala probably is the most dangerous thing on the planet because you can only kill them with fire.
Wow. Well, I promise you, we will not tease you about koalas. We will not slip koala gifs into your DMs. You're safe. You're amongst friends here.
It takes a village, you know. So,
well, before we dive into the things that are going on with Bandai right now, we start off all of our interviews with this question: what are you currently collecting right now?
See, that is. When I saw it, I'm like, man, because in my line of work, I collect everything, right? So it's almost like I have to parse out, like, what do I collect for myself versus what do I collect as just part of my craft and what I do, right? So as I was thinking about it, I'm like, okay, well, if I wasn't really doing anything for work, like, what would I just sort of be collecting if I really didn't already have it? I actually collect... /design lightsaber hilts.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's these companies out there that, like, if you, you know, give them a drawing or they have like a little online tool, you can sort of mix and match your own lightsaber hilt together and then they'll tool it and make it for you. And so that's what I would be collecting if I didn't already have some already.
Now I'm curious. I actually have one of those. I have I have an Ultra Saber.
Okay.
From that particular company. I do have a couple of the Force Effects lightsabers, which is kind of what got me into it. But I wanted one that was designed after one of my favorite kind of B-list Jedi Council members. I wanted one that was kind of like Kit Fisto's lightsaber, and I couldn't really find a good version of it, but Ultra Sabers had one. So I have a third party Kit Fisto inspired green lightsaber from Ultra Sabers.
That's pretty cool. Okay.
I was going to say, the only lightsaber I have is from Galaxy's Edge, but...
Does that count?
I did the... what's it called? Jedi Temple where you can make your own.
Yeah. I think the first one's just sort of like an off-the-rack one, right? I'm like, okay, fine, you know, because it was like cool looking. And then I wanted to go deep, right? Because everyone has like, you know, Obi-Wan's, whatever it is. And so then... I saw one. I think Saber Forge made it. I'm not sure. Maybe it's FX. It was from the game Rom Coda. It have his lightsaber, right? And it's sort of like weathered, and it has like the tape around it and that kind of stuff. And so I said, "Oh, that's pretty cool." And then once I had that one, then I started just, you know, doing my research and try to figure out like, well, can I just have these made with like a machinist? Like I wouldn't even go to like those places. Just a guy who just machines tools. And so I said, hey, can you do all these things? And a couple of them said, like, yeah, sure, I could do it. And as long as they have the drawing and they can use their own creative license, they do that. I mean, it takes a lot longer, and it's not exactly like off the shelf. But I figured if I were to make one, it would be one that I would have as much flexibility to design the one that I would want, not just picking and choosing from what's available.
Yeah, and that's kind of like it's so fascinating because – I mean, clearly, if you're going through the effort to having your own lightsabers machined, I think it's a fair assumption that you're a Star Wars fan. but it's kind of interesting that like we've gotten to this point, right? Because that's kind of the whole part of the lore of like becoming a Jedi is building your own lightsaber, and you know,
exactly.
in the newest one of the newest games in Jedi Fallen Order, I mean, it's a big part of the gameplay mechanic. So I love the fact that there are companies out there that are you know, doing this sort of thing, and then especially that they're not getting squashed, you know, like they're not getting cease and desist letters,
yeah.
and they're allowed to kind of, you know, live in this galaxy, if you will.
Yeah, it's you know, it's started this little, you know, cottage industry of just people collecting stuff, right? I mean, that's what you guys are all about, and it really is about not being shy or hesitant to, you know, to show off the things that you already have, right? Like I heard from someone sometime, like even if we go into like action figures in general, it actually says a lot more about us than it says about the figure, right? It really is a reflection of ourselves based off of what we collect and display, right? So it's like holding up a mirror.
Yeah, for sure. So getting into now the business end of things, tell us about your relationship with the toy/collectibles industry and how you found your way to Bandai America.
Wow. So how I found my way to Bandai America. So I've been in entertainment most of my career. And at a business school, I started at Disney and in the home video days back when, you know, before DVD and like people were buying like VHS tapes and the Lion King was like everywhere and that kind of stuff. And I got in very, very early, and I stayed with Disney for a couple of years. Then I moved over to Warner Brothers, and I did the home video stuff there. And I did a lot of the new to DVD theatrical releases. So if you have like the Dark Knight on Blu-ray, and most households do, I was part of that team that sort of put everything together, right? And I'd always been a comic book fan. And so I guess a good 10, 15 years, maybe 10 years ago, when DC Comics was officially moving from New York to LA on the Warner Brothers lot, I like, that's my opportunity. And so I talked with folks and all the stuff that kind of goes along with it. And before I knew it, I was working at DC Comics. And basically I was managing the DC Comics brand for all the different affiliates in the world, basically saying, you know, Batman would do this and not this, and Wonder Woman has her lasso on this side, not that side, and just, you know, working on the films and the movies to make sure that we were telling the right stories that would fit each character. And so I had a pretty good run with that. And then we just have new opportunities. And through a friend, oddly enough, that we used to work with at Warner Brothers, I saw this opening at Bandai for something very, very similar, right? And I had never really been like a super anime fan, but I had watched a couple, right? But I had never really read any of the manga and stuff. So I was the casual fan, if you would really define it that way. And I met with the folks and they liked me and I liked them. And I saw some of the stuff that I would be working on in the future. And it just seemed like the right time to sort of not make a complete left turn, but sort of detour a little bit. Working in a space where the fans are just as vigorously enthusiastic about the property as comic book fans, right? So it was kind of the same song, but a different dance. And I've been here for a little over a year now. So I started, I actually started right before COVID hit at Toy Fair in 2020.
That was our first media event, actually, was Toy Fair.
Yeah.
We were there.
Yeah.
So you mentioned in kind of that your history, and by the way, like, super cool, like, getting to work with all those properties and,
yeah,
and kind of, you know, it's very, very, very cool background that I think probably gives you a lot of help in what you're doing now, like you had alluded to.
Yeah.
But as a casual fan, and you know, Dave and I are both, Dave, you would say that you're a casual anime fan at best. I'm probably just a hair more well-versed than you are at this point.
I would say a bit more than a hair, but yes, I am quite casual.
You mentioned that you had that casual background. Were there any of the properties that you work with today? Like, did you have a personal history with really any of them?
Yeah, actually. So it's funny because, and this is one of the things that we discuss at work all the time. What is the future of anime? Like, what is it? Is anime really what anime is? Like, and I almost say it as two sides of the same coin, because what people see as anime today is not what they saw anime was 5-10 years ago, even though the content's the same, right? Easily, Dragon Ball, yes, it's anime, but it's such a mainstream, the way that it came along, the way that it sort of entered its way into like Western culture, that a lot of people just sort of see it as animated content, right? And so as I was growing up as a kid, you know, I loved watching the cartoons as much as any other kid, but I stumbled on some of the old classic anime, right? And this was like longer form content. And I think my first real exposure to it was like Robotech, like the Macross Saga, right? And for the first time, like, they continued. Right? Like, I love like the Super Friends, right? But like, if you miss like the third episode, like, nothing's going to change, right? But for something that has like seasons and like dozens of episodes, like, it's a continuing storyline that really struck me as a kid and even growing up. And I remember thinking like, wow, there's like consequences to this story. Like, people die, you know, and I felt sad for some of the characters, or I was actually like emotionally invested in watching the next episode. And I think it struck me that, like, wow, there's this great piece of storytelling that's sort of also a, for lack of a better word, a cartoon, right? And that got me aware of the power that animated content can really have that's outside of like a movie, right? Anime is a behavior, right? You go to the movies, it's an event, right? Anime, it's a behavior. It's something that you do, right? Like, some of these things go for hundreds of episodes and it's a time commitment, right? So you just can't like dabble in it. And so I think as I'm working at Bandai now and I'm becoming more of the hardcore fan just by way of researching and watching some of the stuff that I'm working on, I have a much deeper appreciation for the content that I grew up with as a kid.
That is a really, really good point. I never really thought about that, but thinking about it now, like, I'm 33 years old. So I was right in the kind of like target market for the United States' launch of Pokemon. You know, when that anime came to the United States, and also when Dragon Ball Z premiered on Toonami. And I'm trying to think, like, really before then, that probably is my introduction to long form storytelling like that. I never really thought about it like that.
And before then, you had my generation where, like, literally, unless you knew somebody who had access to stuff, you, like, the only thing you saw was Akira and like Ghost in the Shell and some Miyazaki stuff. Like, and so that's where my kind of what I know is.
Yeah, like, even, you know, you mentioned Miyazaki. Like, now, like, you know, kids now are spoiled because they have, there's a whole Miyazaki portal on HBO Max, right? Like, you have access to literally every single one of those films. And, you know, there was a brief period of time where I think Disney had the distribution rights for the Miyazaki films, and they were kind of readily available then. But even before then, like, mm-hmm. I mean, Totoro's as old as I am, and I didn't see it until I was in my 20s.
Yeah, I think that was when Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away were out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. You know, it really is it's a fascinating medium that I think one of the appeals. So if you mentioned, like, when you first saw Dragon Ball for the first time, like, I think one of the reasons why Dragon Ball is so strong is because it really was the first of its kind. If you look at all the other cartoons that were out there that were like action cartoons, it was unlike Dragon Ball, right? Like, Dragon Ball had these pretty mature themes that didn't really pander to kids, right? It was about consequences and loss and overcoming your fears. And like, I'm waxing a little poetic in terms of how significant they are. And yes, there was humor mixed in with it too, right? But that was combined with, like, visually over the top action and speed lines and battle sequences that, like, went on probably, like, way too long, but it made such an impact that no one had ever seen anything like that before. Like, I think that was when people for the first time realized, like, this was something different, right? And then as new people started watching anime, and even now, right, like, the door is open, right? Finding anime is not hard, whether it's Hulu, Netflix, Crunchyroll, whatever it might be. Whoever is in that portal now, whoever has opened that door and can pick and choose, this really is like an anime renaissance, I think, that translates itself into everything from merch to toys to collectibles to video games, like, you name it. I think it's an exciting time.
So with that said, with that expansion and that accessibility that we're talking about coming into play, how did the Dragon Stars line come to be?
Well, it's funny. So Dragon Stars has been around for 3 or 4 years, a little bit longer. And it really started with taking what Bandai does best, right, in terms of just its exposure to the anime space and the strength that it has just in the technology of making action figures, right? So if you have, like, the superhero figure arts and Tamashii Nations and like 87 points of articulation and hyper articulated detail and all the kind of things like that, I think Dragon Stars was a way to say, how can we make this accessible at a price point where people can discover it, right, and then have an appreciation for it, right? So it's not like it's a little plastic statue that doesn't do anything, right? And it's not like it's this, like, $80 piece that is more of a piece of art than anything else, and you don't want to mess it up, right? The trick was to find something that is cool to look at that'll fit on shelf with all the other action figures that are out there, right? But really carve out a space in the action figure section that people can appreciate and discover for the first time, right? Because if you look at all the Dragon Stars that are out now, and I think there's like 56, 57 styles, like, they're not wrestlers. They're not superheroes, right? Every one of them looks dramatically different than the rest. Like, that is unlike any form factor of an action figure that exists out there, right? And so I think it really made itself a nice little place in the corner of the room that we're starting to own and expand out, right? That basically says, if you want a spot on interpretation from the anime to the action figure, like, that is Dragon Stars. You look at them and you put it right next to an animation cell, it looks just like it. And it's really, really hard to do. But we have some fantastic folks in Tokyo in our R&D department who, you know, painstakingly work with the licensors to make sure that we have these, you know, hyper-accurate representations of all of our, you know, most famous characters of Dragon Ball.
So with that corner that you mentioned, you know, carving out that you know space in somebody's collection, or even you know space at retail, because you know you can find these Dragon Star figures both at Walmart, and, you know, Target. Yeah. You can find them brick and mortar. You can find them on Amazon. You know, at that $20 to $25 price point, depending on the the figure. Not to mention that doesn't even bring into to consideration like the Limit Break line, the 12-inch figures.
Right.
You know, there's which, by the way, my daughter, I'm introducing her, my eldest daughter, not the 6 month old, not introducing the six month old to Dragon Ball Z yet, but the 6 year old. We're actually watching Dragon Ball Z Kai, and I have never seen Kai, the redone version of Dragon Ball Z. So,
yeah.
We're watching it together, and I'm introducing her for the first time, and she has 12-inch figures from, you know, you name it. Every brand has their line of 12-inch guys, whether it's the Spin Master DC guys, whether it's the the Hasbro Titan series, and now the Limit Breaker or the Limit Break, excuse me. So, like, personally, I think it's incredible that in 2021, like, she's got these 12-inch figures that all scale with her Barbie figures, frankly, if she wants to, you know, interplay.
Uh-huh.
But, like, great sculpts, great art deco on them. And we picked up Vegeta the other day from Target for $14. Like, I couldn't believe it. but with that whole kind of section carved out for this series of figures, and with the success of the more kind of collector focused, like you mentioned, the SH Figure Arts line, and the made to order pieces from Premium Bandai, what's really like, who is the focus of the Dragon Stars? Who is really kind of being the, who is the target for this line?
That is the million-dollar question, right? So on the marketing side, which is sort of, you know, where I practice my craft, so to speak, the hardest thing is figuring out the difference between your target consumer and the person who's going to buy it, right? Now, to a certain extent, like, if you're buying for a four-year-old, right, the four-year-old isn't going to be, I want that, right, because they can't really articulate it yet, right? Once a kid starts asking for the toy, then it gets really kind of muddy, right? And so we know that specifically with Dragon Stars, right, they're great looking figures, got the great articulation, $20, right? So it's, you know, it's, they're affordable. We find that there's two overlapping segments, right? There is the hardcore Dragon Ball fan who just collects all things Dragon Ball, right? So that person's always going to be there. And then you have people who may be discovering it for the first time. And they may be kids, they may be older collectors, they may be the collector who grew up with it, who then wants to buy it for their kid, right? So there's like all these intersections of possible segments that are exposed to this that will purchase it because we have like the sales data. But in terms of who it's actually for, the best that we can do is message out to one particular segment. And that message sometimes gets overheard by the people standing next to them. But we don't always know who's standing next to the person who we are aiming that communication towards. So it's not really a super clean answer, I guess, because, you know, you really don't know. Like, you have an idea that this is the person you're going after, and then you hope that you reach them. But in terms of who's actually consuming it, that's a little bit tougher, especially at that like $20 price point. Because once you're getting into like the, you know, $75, $50 action figure range, for the most part, kids aren't going to be playing with it. You know, it's going to be the adult collector, right? But if it's like within that lower $20 to $30, it gets a little foggy.
Yeah, because I mean, I'll tell you, like, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we were walking down the toy aisle, and in our particular Target, the I'll just call it the Bandai section, I guess, because it's got the, you know, the Anime Heroes, the Dragon Stars, it's got the model kits. It has some SH Figure Arts figures now, like there's some Gokus that are there. When we were walking down that aisle, and it's right next to like the wrestlers and right across the aisle from the Marvel Legends figures, really, really great spot. When we were walking by, like, now that she has character recognition from the show, she was like, Vegeta, can I get Vegeta? And, you know, it was like, first of all, my heart, I was like, she likes it. And then second of all, I was like, you can absolutely get Vegeta. Because when I was a kid, the only Vegeta figure that I could get was the Irwin Toys repackaged release of the early Bandai ones, where like it had literally had 2 points of articulation. The arms moved up and down, and it had a removable Saiyan armor. Like that was it. And they repainted that figure like 6 times to make him Super Saiyan. They make him like gold and shiny. Yeah, it was but I still had a blast with those things. But like now, like, you know, to think that, you know, I'm holding the Dragon Stars Jiren in my hand right now. I recently picked this guy up. I'm personally floored by them, because as somebody who has SH Figure Arts figures, like, I see a lot of the, it's almost like a, like, transitional, right? So, like, you pop off the hands, and it looks like the joint system is very similar. Like, the way that the pegs are designed, the way that the butterfly joints kind of work, the way that the double joints and the ankles kind of work. Like, it's like, I don't want to say it's not fair to say like it's a watered down SH Figure Arts figure, because that's not fair to these, nor is it fair to the SH Figure Arts figures. But it is its own thing, and they're really neat. And I took some photos of them today, in action, and you know that they really, at the $20 price point, they really are. I think it's a great figure.
Yeah. No. It's They're for the value, they're pretty good, you know. And to your point, I think there is a lot of transition factor there, right? And once you sort of get into it, because, you know, like, so if you go into retail, right, and I'm not talking like Amazon or where you can just click everywhere, but like when you see one of these things on shelf, right, like they pop out, you're like, okay, this is interesting. And if you pick it up and you're like, wow, these are pretty cool, right? Like, we want to know, like, are they picking it up because it's a cool looking figure? Because they are. Or are they picking it up because it's Dragon Ball? Or is it a little bit of both? And then if it's the latter, then is this the first experience they've had with owning a piece of Dragon Ball stuff, right? And does that mean that if they continue to have affinity for that property, are they going to scale up? Are they going to go for the higher end version that'll have the different faces and more accessories and all that kind of stuff like that? So I think it's a continuum. But it definitely, I think, can be a starting point for a lot more.
Now, speaking of starting points, one of the things that you, I recently had the opportunity to watch you present at the Toy Insider Suite, which was a lot of fun. And you recently showed off the other kind of, I guess you could say, entry point into the world of the Dragon Ball Z figures is the Evolution line. And the three new figures that are coming to Evolution. So, like, kind of where does that fit in to this whole, like, bigger picture? Because those figures are also super articulated, great detail, and, you know, are a different character selection.
Right. And you're referring to the 5-inch Evolve line, right?
Yes. Sorry, I said Evolution. Yeah, Evolve. Yes. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. The Evolve line, I guess, is, I think, more for the casual fan, just because, like, they're $9.99, right? And the packaging is in a blister pack. Like, it's nice, but it's not like collectible packaging per se. I think those two things together already make it lean more towards, you know, younger kids and people just starting to, like, here's a cool looking action figure. Not to say that, like, core fans and collectors of Dragon Ball, they're not going to buy these. Like, they will buy them, right? Like, one, they're like $10. Two, they're actually really, really good detail. So it's kind of a gimme, right? So, I mean, universally, anyone who's seen the Evolve line, right? And we have our third wave that's going to be coming out in just a few months. When they look at them, they're like, wow, these are really good. Like, they're really impressed that for a $10 figure, the level of detail and articulation and just how solid they feel in your hand. You know, they're selling extremely well, right? But I'm pretty sure most of the people buying them are buying them for their kids. Yes, there's going to be collectors doing it, but when you go that kind of packaging and that kind of price point, you're putting yourself squarely in the mass market. That is probably going to be the majority of the folks who are going to buy these things.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of begs the question, you know. Dragon Ball is a property that has 40 years of stories that have been told thus far. So how do you go about deciding which characters are introduced into the line?
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? I think it's easy at the beginning, right? So when when Drag Stars first started, right? You're like, oh, should we put Goku? Yes, you put Goku, right? Should I put yes, you put Vegeta, right? Because at a certain point in time, it's like, okay, how many are we going to release in the first wave? And Lord knows there are plenty of characters in the Dragon Ball universe. So the first couple waves are easy enough, right? It really becomes a function of how quickly can we make them? And will the retailers take them all, right? Because regardless of how much a retailer loves your product, they're not going to give you 300 feet of space, right? Like they have other products that they carry too. So they have to pick and choose. So you have to make sure that whatever you're choosing is going to be something the retailers are going to understand is going to sell, right? And as you get more and more and more, things get a little bit more challenging, right? And then you have to substitute in waves. So right now, I even forget what wave we're on, but basically we're like, we're in the mid-50s, right? 54, 56 characters in. And for the most part, we've already touched the main characters a couple times, right? Like Goku Saiyan version 2, Saiyan 4, Super Saiyan 5, Super Saiyan Blue, Goku. Like there's like 8 different versions of Goku, which is fine because he's a popular character, right? So the first thing we have to look at is it going to be popular, right? Like, are enough people going to understand this is what it is? It can't be just like, here's Goku with like one red shoe, right? Like that probably wouldn't sell too much, right? Unless it was central to the storyline and that's the one, right? But for the most part, it has to be different enough to make sense, right? And then it has to be, and in the industry, the toy industry, we call it, is it toyetic? Right? Is it going to look like a cool looking action figure? And here's the best example that I can give. If I was working with a property and everyone in that property wore, let's just say, stormtrooper uniforms, and the only thing different was the face, well, then you really wouldn't be able to tell one character from the other from far away. So it wouldn't be very toyetic, right? I might release one or two of them, but to release 5 or 6, they're not different enough. Right. So one, I got to figure out, is it going to be a popular enough character? Two, is it going to just look good on shelf and be differentiated? Right. And then three, right, like, are enough people going to want to buy it? Right. Because when you're making these action figures, you know, the molds to make these things is pretty expensive. Right. So there are, you know, tens of thousands of units required in order to like break even on the mold in order to sell them. Right. So if you're only going to make like 3,000 of them, like it probably is not going to pay out financially, right? And so it's this balancing act, right? And it's a portfolio approach. We'll release a character that might not be super popular, but that everyone loves because it will keep the fans excited. And the other more popular Goku and Vegetas of the world, they will sort of carry the load, right? For this other character that maybe only showed up in one season, but has its own following, right? So there's all these different little levers and considerations that you have to put in to figure out like what's the best character, right? So, and we go through this process on a continual basis. You know, our R&D folks in Japan, they'll be like, okay, we're going to be releasing 2 new action figures this season, and it's going to be this one and this one. What do you think? And we have a combination, right? And so I say like, okay, is this what the final thing is going to look like, and why this character? We already have 4 versions of this character. We have 10 versions of this character. Do we think it's the right choice? Is there another one that we should be doing before this, right? Is there a new show coming out? Is there a new movie coming out that then we can, you know, make an action figure for? So all these things are happening all at the same time. And we got to be thinking 18 months ahead because that's sort of the timeline that we operate in.
Wow. So it's an 18-month process from kind of ideation to store shelves?
Roughly. It depends, but I've seen things fast-tracked in like 12, 13 months, but like everything has to work perfectly from the approvals to the time when the retailers are able to take it in, right? So like your Walmart and Targets of the world, they do like their fall set, right? And they have like their spring set. And those are the two main times when they take in new stuff. So depending on when it's ready to ship, if you don't follow one of those windows, you have to wait till the next cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where you can have that extra 4 or 5 month buffer at the end that you just have to hurry up and wait.
So, I mean, now it's you know, again, sticking with, I know there is way more to talk about than just the Dragon Ball content, but kind of sticking with that just for one more minute here, there, now that there isn't any kind of, like, I think there's talk of, like, Akira Toriyama working on a new Dragon Ball Z movie, or Dragon Ball Super movie, but, like, now that there's kind of, like, a lull in new content outside of maybe, you know, video games for the IP, do you guys look at, like, a time like this where it's like, okay, like, now let's go back and look at some of those characters that, you know, we kind of buried in order to produce kind of the hot characters, trying to keep up with the content that was getting pumped out through Super and things like that? Like, do you take the opportunity now to go back and, like, say, you know, like, maybe a character that's not, you know, somebody who's involved in the action as heavily, like, you know, your Bulmas, your Chi-Chi's, like, the kind of the very important characters, but more, you know, kind of in that B tier, you would say.
Yes, we have that conversation all the time. I think what happens is, depending on when content may or may not be coming out, we'll look at our roster and we say, when is it a good time to, you know, go into the toy box, you know, and sort of dig up one that hasn't either been released in a while, or maybe refresh something, or maybe it's a new deco for a character, or a slightly different tool, right? There's all these different iterations that we can look at. That really is, it's dependent on lots of other things. But yes, we always look at what's available to us, because if there is a lull in content, then that's sort of the only, you know, that's our most efficient option to get the fans excited about something.
The other thing that I think is really interesting about something that you're doing with Dragon Stars that I feel like I actually frankly can't think of any other companies that are doing it at retail in this scale, but Bandai was kind enough to send us out a sample of the tournament playset a couple of months ago.
Martial Arts Stage, yeah.
And it is easily the best 1/12 scale playset available on the market today. Like, hands down, like, they're you know, there's really no other competition for it, but it's amazing. And like I said, while there are a few others attempting to make stuff like this in this scale, what kind of convinced you to bite the bullet and make a 1/12 scale playset?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was, you know, our wonderful folks in Tokyo, and they come up with ideas all the time. And originally, they had pitched us this as a more of a higher end display kit, right? And we saw, like, models and, like, mock-ups of it. We're like, wow, this is, like, really, really cool. And originally it was positioned very much like, this is a place where, you know, it was more higher end, right? I mean, the price point was still, like, you're like $29.99, but we were looking at it and we're just sort of like, this is kind of, you know, we held it off for one or two cycles, and it wasn't until we actually started putting some characters on it, and I think we even had it at Toy Fair, and we saw a lot of kids really gravitating towards it, and it became like, this is almost like a playset. It's not a display set, right? And we saw that difference, right? And that's where we had this younger audience, and it was when we started thinking about how many Dragon Ball characters do people have, right? Most people don't have just one. They order and they buy multiple ones, right? Which then means you got to put them somewhere, right? Now, are you just going to put them on a shelf? Are you just going to put them back in the box? Are you going to put them in your sock drawer? Like, wherever it might be, right? And I think we stumbled on something where having a set 1/12 scale that is iconic, right? That shows up, not in every episode, but enough episodes where everyone knows, oh, here's that thing, and you can fit half a dozen characters on there. That's when we realized that we had something. That's when we said, like, oh, we really should position and market this as more of a younger playset that also can be for your more hardcore fans that actually want a place to put all their stuff. So that's sort of how it came about, right? Because to create a playset or display set, lots of things have to happen. It has to work in real time and space. So I can't have, like, a giant mountain, right? And then not have anything interact with it, right? Like, it was a neat little structure that exists in the show that people recognize that I think all the forces sort of aligned and made for a compelling product.
Yeah, and it has great play features too. So like one of the communities that, you know, we participate in quite frequently through the podcast is the toy photography community. And that thing is talk about toyetic. It's not only is it toyetic, it's photogenic. It works really well, like you said, kind of as this display piece, but, you know, like being able to swap out the middle tile to make it look like somebody got drilled through the floor, you know, it has these, and like you can kind of break things in various stages of, you know, it could be in various stages of disrepair, you know, depending on the amount of, you know, damage that frankly, that Goku's probably doing to it. It works really well, and it's I wish more companies would take the plunge and do playsets like that for that scale, because it clearly works. And I mean, the box that it comes in is not large. Like I was surprised when I got it how small the footprint was, and then what was actually in there. And after I built it, I was like, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah, it's a pleasant surprise.
Aside from the Dragon Stars figures, Bandai is also producing the Anime Heroes line.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Anime Heroes was almost like a little spin-off of Dragon Stars, right? Like we knew that the 6.5-inch action figure for Dragon Ball was doing really, really well, right? But Dragon Ball is like too big to be contained by anime, right? And so part of our thinking was we wanted to be able to take our expertise and I guess the technology, right, of making a really detailed action figure for like $20. And how can we take the very best anime and use that form factor to introduce great anime to fans? And so that's sort of how Anime Heroes started, right? And we started with Naruto and with Saint Seiya. And we started that maybe 18, 20 months ago, and it has been enormously successful. Like Naruto, we can't keep him on the shelves, and we have like 9 characters now. And it's done so well that we want to continue to go back to the well, and we say, okay, what is the next IP intellectual property franchise that we want to be able to add to Anime Heroes? And in April, we decided that we were going to release One Piece, right? Because it's the greatest selling manga of all time and arguably one of the big three. So you can't not have One Piece. And it's also doing very, very well. And so we sort of captured this lightning in a bottle, and we're always on the hunt for new anime, not just the old classic stuff that either might be still going on, but like what's the new hot anime that's happening right now that is still new enough and relevant enough that 13 to 18 months from now we can put on shelf before a show sort of either, you know, has already set its course, or is it just starting to crest, or are people just starting to discover it again? So, you know, that's sort of the short log line of how we got started and our overall plan for this line.
So that being said, going back to the conversation that we had at Sweet Sweet last week, you mentioned that there are some new IPs. I think you said that there were three that are going to be joining the line. I know you probably can't reveal what any of them are. Are there any hints that you can maybe give our listeners to start start the gears going in their brains?
Yeah, I guess the only hint I can give it would be like this, and it's the same hint that I gave when I knew One Piece was coming out, but we couldn't reveal anything yet, and the story is the same. If you can think of in your head 5 or 6 anime properties that if you were the boss and you had to make action figures for, what properties would they be, right? And if you have those things in your mind, odds are probably 2 or 3 of them at the top of your list are the ones we're actually going to release next, right? Like it's not going to surprise everybody. Once we reveal what our 3 new properties are going to be, people are going to be like, okay, yes, that makes sense, right? It will not be like, why? Like, that is such an obscure anime, right? Or it only had like 1 episode, or like nobody watched it. Like, it won't be one of those things. It will be either a fan favorite, It will be something that's been around for a while. It'll be something that is just catching fire now, like, or a mix of all three. So fans will not be disappointed, and they will not be surprised.
All right. And I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked you at the event last week. Are any of these contemporary, current running anime shows, or are they ones that have kind of a historical significance that are no longer running?
I would say yes and yes.
Good, but, you gave the same answer.
But I could easily say the same thing for One Piece. Like, it's still going, like, 15 years later. So if someone were to say, like, is it contemporary? Yes. Is it historical? Yes. Is it one of the big three? Yes. Like, granted, now that's just One Piece, right?
Yeah.
I could have said the same thing for Naruto, right?
Yeah.
So it and one of the things that is very fortunate, especially now, as people are discovering anime, like, for the very first time, there isn't really such thing as an old anime just because people are rediscovering it, right? Like, if someone happened on One Piece for the first time, like, and there's like close to 1,000 episodes now, and they're watching, you know, 2 episodes a day for an hour, I mean, do the math. Like, it's going to take you years, right? So there's always new stuff going on and new content. So we're not so much worried about, is something relevant? Because relevant really is a function of how often are people watching something they've just discovered.
Yeah, I mean, we spent the first 40 minutes of this this interview talking about an anime that has been going since, you know, for 40 years. And right now, as we record this episode, has currently reached a stopping point where there is no new content that's been officially announced or anything that's officially on the horizon with a release date. So, you know, but that line ain't going anywhere.
Well, you know, I mean, to pull a page from my days at DC Comics, like, oh, when are you going to have a new Batman? Batman's been around for like 75 years. Like, he's not hurting for groceries, right? He'll be doing just fine, right?
Yep.
So the same thing can be said with the best anime. It's like, because it's classic for a reason, because it's made of stories and characters that really resonate with the fan. And when fans have an affinity and they have an emotional connection to these characters, they're going to want to express themselves as a function of owning those characters. So it's, as long as the fans are there, there's going to be demand for it.
So speaking of the fans, we're fans of the work that Bandai does, and a lot of our audience are fans of the work that
Absolutely.
Bandai does. So when we have a guest on, we like to ask our audience if they have any questions for our guest. And we have a couple of we actually have 3 questions today from our audience that we have kind of two of which we have kind of distilled from a lot of very similar questions and then one very specific one. So,
okay.
Dave, do you want to kick us off with our first question?
Sure. This one is a distilled combination. Is it true that Digimon and Tamagotchi are coming back, and can you tell us more about that?
So the answer is yes. Tamagotchi and Digimon are back, right? After like 20 some odd years at Bandai, right? Like, we created these things a couple decades ago, and we are re-releasing them, right? So Tamagotchi's been around the re-release, you know, for 3 or 4 years now. And it's kind of retaken the world by storm. And people who grew up with it, they'll be like, oh my gosh, I remember what it is, right? So there's a nostalgia play to it, right? And then we're adding new colors and new shapes. And Digimon's no different, right? So about 14, 15 months ago, we decided to re-release the original Digimon. So we called it the 20th Anniversary Edition, right? And it was that same red brick Digimon device that everyone knows. And since that time, we've released almost 14 different colors, right? There's a white and a black one and a glow in the dark and all these things, right? And they've been doing very, very well. And we're going to continue to make more. And just recently we launched Digimon X, which is sort of like the new evolution of battling for the Digimon device. So yes, so we're always looking to innovate. We're always trying to figure out like what's going to be that next great big Digimon move in the future, right? That isn't necessarily tied to any new content, right? Because yes, there's the movies and there's the shows that are currently running on TV and there's like video games. But when it comes to the actual device, it's connected to the property, but it still is a little bit separate because it's really the that one thing that started it all, right? So I guess the long answer to the question is yes, they're back. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. I was actually just talking with my boss. We have a multi-year plan for what's happening next in Digimon. So rest assured, there's going to be more cool stuff to come.
Yeah, we actually had this. I'm actually realizing now, Dave, I didn't even tell you about this. We had this really cool moment with the at the panel during Cisco's presentation, where there was a father and his son came in, and the son I think was 5 or 6 years old, and he was absolutely fascinated by the concept of Digimon, where it was like, wait, yeah. I have to be in the same room with my friend, and like we gotta like hold them next to each other. Do you? But like fascinated in a good way. Like he was like jazzed. He was like, I want this, which was really cool to see. Like I was literally watching. I was listening to Cisco talk, and I was watching this young man's eyes just like light, like
yeah, it was
great. That's really cool.
I experienced the same thing. I was talking, he's just like, okay, this he, right? I mean, and as a marketer, right, I really appreciate that because he gets it, right? I didn't have to explain too much what it was. Like, he got it. He's like, oh, okay, like that's different, right? Like, there isn't anything anywhere that he's ever seen that can do this, right? And I said, like, it's 20-year-old technology. It's not like Skyrim. They're 8-bit sprites that exist on a inch and a half screen, right? But there is something about it that's just compelling, and that's you know, for $20, it'll keep you occupied for a while.
I was just gonna say, even like, you know, like Tamagotchi, like we had those back in the advent of Tamagotchi.
I still have mine. My lime green Tamagotchi from back in the day. I still have it. Still works too.
If you had the green, then I don't remember which color I had. Did I have white?
Yes.
White and blue?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, mine still work. I actually still have two in mine. The little plastic tab that slides between the batteries to turn it off. I still have the original little plastic tab, and that's how I turn it off and prevent the batteries from dying.
So, request time. I don't know if we're going to have like a bell sound effect or anything there.
Probably not, but I might have to add one now.
Yeah, you may have to now. So there are lots of requests for characters, as there tend to be, and IPs like Demon Slayer and more from Naruto. So I guess the question would be, anything you can discuss as far as any of this goes?
This is our opportunity to say, like, listen, we hear you. We are not going to be able to likely get an answer for you, but this is what people are asking us for. So we're just passing this information along to you.
I really appreciate the way that it was asked, in the spirit if it was asked, right? Because it's by a fan. So it's not like they're just saying, hey, remember Dragon Ball? That was really cool. Like, no, it's different. It's showing that they care about a line that I may actually have some influence in doing something about, right? And so as a professional, as a fan, like, that's pretty cool, right? So I guess I'm all for those kind of questions, right? Because it shows the interest and it shows the passion of the fans that are getting me to get paid to do this, which is like a pretty sweet gig, right? So as far as Naruto goes, yes, we will be making more characters, right? That's just, it's doing such a great job that there's no shortage of Naruto characters. We're going to be making more. I've already seen some of the sculpts and the models. They look fantastic. Which ones are they going to be? Can't say. That's the tough part, right? But soon, probably in the next, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, we'll be revealing, you know, to some of the retailers, you know, here's what we're going to be planning. And then maybe 4 or 5 months after that, Toy Fair. And then we're going to, you know, announce our whole line. So Naruto's easy. Demon Slayer is tough. Just because, right, if you remember, we're always operating 18 months out, which means that the next three IP that we're doing, I've known that we're doing for a while, right? Any other work that I was doing before that time may be happening for a while, right? So if something like Demon Slayer is a new hot property that comes in, I have to ask myself, is Demon Slayer going to be that property that cuts in line? Right? And what will be the effect on the other properties that maybe might not have as many seasons left in it? or, you know, maybe are planning on a movie, in which case then we're going to release that character when the movie of that anime comes out. So there's all these different things and left turns that show up in a while. So all I'll say to that is, do we have our eye on Demon Slayer? Absolutely. Do we already make some Demon Slayer stuff? Absolutely, right? Is Demon Slayer going to come into Anime Heroes? I think it would be awesome, but the best way I can answer the question is not just yet, just because there's all these other things that are happening, but it's not an impossibility.
That is such a good answer. Thank you.
It really is.
And our last question for the Q&A here, this one is a specific one, and this one comes from at Shima Collection. First of all, thanks for making Saint Seiya figures. And is there any chance we'll see Silver Saints and or Hades or Poseidon soldiers?
Well, thank you for Saint Seiya. Saint Seiya is one of those tricky properties. It never really quite caught hold in the U.S. market as it did in other countries, right? And a lot of it was just the edits that were made and the music choice. It just sort of – it didn't resonate with the fans at the time. And that's why, like, in, like, South America, it's huge. And other countries, it's huge. But in the U.S., it has its following, but it's not, like, super huge, right? We've released, I think, 6 Saint Seiya figures. We have a 7th one that's going to be coming in the fall. We'll be revealing relatively soon. As far as the Silver Saints and the other ones, we don't have any immediate plans yet. It's not like we don't have the rights to make more, because we do, right? Again, it kind of goes back to the same question. Like, the answer is not no, just not yet, right? And the question is, you know, does Saint Seiya take let's just say Naruto hadn't come out yet, right? And we decide Naruto is going to be that next IP. Does Saint Seiya get in front of line of Naruto? Like, I don't know. And that's just not for me to decide, right? That is for Viz to decide. That's for the licensor to decide. That's for, like, Bandai Namco Holdings and all the different stakeholders that go into the business decision-making process. So it's a very complicated answer to a simple question, oddly enough. But I guess for the fans, I guess I can offer this little piece of solace, right? And that is that I actually read all the Twitter posts and the Reddit chains. And so I know what fans are thinking. And so if enough fans want something and they're vocal enough online, I read it. And I know what I can do, right? So it's like, what can we control, right? And so if I have the power to do something because fans really like something, that's stuff I can tell the folks who are actually making these things, right? So it's not like it's this, we're in this little, you know, glass wall where we can't see out. We kind of know what's going on. And we always want to make sure that we take care of our fans.
Awesome. And that wraps up our Q&A. You did it. You survived.
Yay.
Dave, why don't you fulfill your role as this podcast's James Lipton and bring us on home with our final question?
Sure. As previously stated, our final question. It's our final question to all of our guests. What is your favorite and or strangest piece in your collection? It can be one of each or it can be both.
I have a very dear friend that I worked with when I was at Warner Brothers, and I had worked in all the Harry Potter movies. And part of my job when I was working on these movies was to, you know, like on the higher end ones, like if you buy this at Target, you get the movie plus like a little collectible coin, right? Or you get like the special packaging, or you get that sort of that add-on, right? And so I was in this account exclusive business, and a lot of times I would work with this particular person, and she would come to me with different prototypes of how about this kind of package, or how about this, or this might be really cool, right? One of the things that I worked on that never made the light of day, and there's only one that exists in the entire world I have, is this. So from Harry Potter, it's a solid brass snitch, right? From like the, you know, the Quidditch games, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the snitch comes in two pieces, right? And so when you split that snitch apart in that sphere, it's actually a USB that holds all of the movies.
Huh. That's cool.
And we tried to make it available, but like it would be so expensive at the time and what would the packaging be like? And there were like, this was before like really digital distribution and people didn't really watch movies on their computers just yet. Some did. And were there piracy issues? And all these things made a great idea, just not viable. Right. And so I have the only one that exists. And to be truthful, I've never even tried to play the movies inside. I don't even know if they're even there. But I have the solid brass snitch that is super heavy, looks awesome, and it potentially has all the movies on there. So I think that's my coolest collection that I know no one else in the world has.
That is an awesome one of one. That is it. Yeah. That is a really cool for one sure. of one. Well, Cisco, before we let you go, we want to say thank you for taking the time to be on the show, for walking us through all of the amazing things that Bandai is working on, that we talked about today. Again, before we let you go, where can we find you on social media, and where can we find out more about Bandai?
Well, Bandai, you can always go to Bandai.com. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter, Bandai America. And in our website, they have all of our links. My own self, I'm on LinkedIn. I think it's like Cisco-Maldonado, or surprisingly enough, and it's funny, as I've been doing these interviews, you know how you always kind of like Google yourself every once in a while? If you just put in Cisco Maldonado and like Bandai, there's enough stuff that pops up there that people can find my social handle. So I have a footprint now. So thanks, fans.
Awesome. Yeah, and hopefully this gets added to your Google resume.
I'll make sure I post it for all my fans to laugh at.
Well, Cisco, thank you again one last time so much for being on Adventures in Collecting.
Well, it was my pleasure. I'm glad you can have me.
Thank you, dear listener, for hanging out with us today. Subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen, and then tell your friends to do it. Thanks also to Joe Azari, the golden voice behind our intro. Our music is Game Boy Horror by the Zombie Dandies. Find more about them both in our show notes.
Follow us on social media at AIC_podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Stop by and say hi, show us your toy hauls, and share your toy stories. Maybe we'll talk about it in a future episode.
Don't try this at home. Void where prohibited and some assembly required. Each sold separately, not a flying toy. Consult a physician if your toy run exceeds more than 4 hours.
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.